We live in a broken world full of broken people. Hurting people hurt people. But how do you find healing from your brokenness? How do you find the wholeness that Jesus promised in John 10:10 when he said, I've come to give you life and life to the full? Today we interview men's ministry icon Pat Morley about his newest book, From Broken Boy to Mended Men. And you're going to walk away learning how to identify what your brokenness is, finding healing for your soul, and forgiving those who have hurt you.
It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who was actually in the arena, whose face is marked by dust and sweat and blood.
Welcome to the Men in the Arena podcast, sponsored by Mountain Tough Fitness Lab, where we interview specialists in the realm of manhood. Each of our guests is an expert in their chosen field or cause as it relates to men. Our conviction is to call you into the arena of manhood, call you out of the faceless, nameless bleachers, and call you up to be the best version of you. Because when a man gets it, everyone wins. Enjoy today's episode.
In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 27, Paul says, I discipline my body and make it my slave. You know, we often forget, guys, that God has called us to steward the bodies he gave us so that we'll be ready, healthy, and spiritually dangerous to fight the good fight, whether it's working at your job, serving your God, protecting your bride, or being a great dad to your kids. That's why we're so excited to partner with Mountain Tough Fitness Lab. Mountain Tough Fitness Lab is run by Christian men who are passionate about training you to be your best version and to stay dangerous and ready for God. Join me on my journey by going to mountaintough.com. That's MTNTOUGH and getting your free 6-week trial when you type in the code ARENA30. You won't be disappointed. Stay dangerous. What type of dad are you? Guys, in my 35 years of ministry, I've noticed that guys basically fall into two categories. And in those categories, there are four types of dad or four phases that you pass through as a dad. We just dropped an amazing quiz to help you discover what type of dad you are. Find out what type of father you are and get our custom resources fit to meet the needs and the questions you are asking. Head on over to menarena.org. Join 20,000 men from around the world and find out the type of dad you are. Men in the Arena Army, we salute you. Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the Men in the Arena podcast. I'm Jim Ramos, your host and guide, leading you to your best version in that stress bubble of life and beyond. Welcome to today's episode. But before we jump into our interview with legendary Patrick Morley, let's go into one of our hero stories. Again, a hero story is something that you have sent into us that you've witnessed in the life of another man, whether it's your husband or a friend, or whether you've witnessed it in your own personal life. We are gathering one hero story for every day of the year. This one comes in number 32. Again, it comes from my friend Sam down in Reedley, California. He runs a men's group down there. And man, what a great story. If you are a small group leader, send us your hero stories. And listen, if you have not received your team captain's flag yet, make sure you hit us up and say, hey, I'm a team captain leading a group of men with your curriculum. We want to send you a Men in the Arena flag because we want you to send a picture of your team, send it back to us. Anyway, here's a story that he relays to us. He's going through one of my books, Strong Men, Dangerous Times, not the workbooks. He's going through the actual book, which is right over my right shoulder right here. And in that book, they were talking about fighting apathy and making an impact on people in this world. One of the coaches was deeply impacted by that message. And I'll tell you what, you teachers in the public school, man, you're in the belly of the beast. You are in the heart of it, man. You are really needing to stand up and be a light in what I believe is a dark place. And this guy, he's a coach, and he realized he needed to be more engaged with his student athletes instead of just coaching and walking away, that he needed to make an investment in their lives if he saw a need. And one day, he was just minding his own business and doing his coaching thing, and he noticed that one of his students seemed to be very distressed. And so he walked up to that student, and that student confided in him that she was depressed. and contemplating suicide. He asked her, he went out, way out of his comfort zone. He asked her if he could pray with her. She said yes. And so he got to pray with this gal. He actually ended up, and he'd never ever prayed with anyone before. How cool is that? He prayed with her, then he worked with her to talk to her parents about what she was feeling. This man, because of the Men in the Arena group he was involved with, probably prevented a teen suicide. Man, if that's not a hero story, I don't know what is. Man, thank you so much for that hero story. And guys, remember, when you send us your hero story, all you have to do is hit us up at info@meninthearena.org with your tangible physical address, and we will send you some swag to say thanks for being a hero. Remember, guys, this is about you and the story that God has put you in. You are the hero in the story that God has given you. I'm excited to bring our guest on today, Pat Morley. Pat lives in Winter Park, Florida, with his beautiful wife of 50 years, Patsy. As a young husband and entrepreneur, Pat was desperate to find meaning and purpose in life. And after thinking, there's got to be more to life than this, he started a Bible study for men in a bar. That study he still teaches to this day. After writing his book, The Man in the Mirror, which was named one of the 100 most influential books of the 20th century, he founded The Man in the Mirror Global Ministry that impacts and has impacted thousands of churches around this country. This guy has gone deep into men's ministry. He is a legend. I'm excited to have him on the show, Mr. Pat Morley, as we address his 23rd book, From Broken Boy to Mended Man. His author name is Patrick Morley, but because he lets me call him his friend, I'm going by Pat. So if you hear me say Pat, it's the same guy I'm looking at on the screen. It's an honor to have you on the call today, Pat. And I just want to say this. You know, going back to the days in my early 30s when I was trying to figure things out, and The Promise Keepers and your book, The Man in the Mirror, you have impacted not only my life, but hundreds of thousands of men around the world. You're still doing it today. And I just want to, on behalf of all of us guys who've been trying to figure it out and you've helped guide us to where we are, thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And thank you, Jim. It's such an honor to be on your show. I've been thrilled to see the progress that you've made, the way that God's favor has rested on this podcast. It's a beautiful thing to watch. And I know that's happening because you've worked hard and you're faithful, but also God has been really good.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah, I didn't need good leadership in this ministry. I needed a miracle, and God gave it to me. And so, and our interview with you about a book you wrote probably 4 books ago, because you're on book 23, The Christian Man. Guys, you got to go into our archives, pull that out. Man, what a wonderful book. And we still have not interviewed you on your book, The Man in the Mirror, which is in the 20th century was viewed as one of the top 100 Christian books written.
Yeah, how about that?
I know. Wow. We got to get you on the show and talk about that one.
Yeah, that's still my number one book, too.
Oh, man. Yeah, so anyway, but it's just...
Although
it's,
I think this book has a chance to go beyond that one, so the one we're going to talk about today.
Well, yeah, you know, so we're talking about From Broken Boy to Mended Man, and, you know, this book, the introduction of the book, you had me hooked, because a lot of guys talk about woundedness and brokenness, and you are this high level entrepreneur, and I didn't know your story. And when you started unfolding your story in this book, I thought, oh man, I'm in. Why don't you give us a little bit of backstory as to your childhood and why you wrote the book, why it took so long to finally write the book? You know, there's a lot going on into this book.
Yeah. Well, so guys, if you're listening, so I grew up in a Christian home that didn't know Christ, if that makes any sense to you. My dad, this story starts 100 years ago, but I won't take 100 years to tell it. But in 1926, when my father was 4 years of age, 2 years of age, the youngest of 4 children, his father abandoned the family. So my dad grew up in a home with a single mom. She did the best they could, but they were extremely poor. So my dad went to work when he was 6 years of age. Never knew a time from six. He had two, actually had 2 jobs. I won't go into the details here, but had 2 jobs at the age of 6 and 8, working with his older brother, who was only 10. And so when dad became a man, he had a decision to make. You know, am I going to repeat the cycle or break the cycle? And of course, they didn't have that language for him back then. But I'm grateful that my dad wanted to break the cycle. But net-net, what it meant to be a man, a husband, a father, or a godly man, husband and father, was not exampled to him. So he did the best that he could, but it didn't work out for him. So I quit high school in the middle of my senior year. You can imagine a very long tale of woes to get to a point where a kid quits high school. My next brother, he followed in my footsteps. He later died of a heroin overdose. My next brother, well, my next two brothers have had way more than their fair share of problems. And so, but then the story took a big shift because I was a very, you know, angry young guy. When I turned 24 and I was about to wreck, I had a very awkward start to my marriage. I was about to wreck that and knew I needed help with the marriage. And so I decided to turn to the one place that in all the world a man ought to be able to go to find some help on how to be a man, a husband, and a father. I one morning took my wife and I reached out for the front door of a church. And what a sacred moment that is when a young guy screws up his courage to do that. All the mothers, grandmothers, and aunties that have been praying sometimes for decades for that to happen, the sovereignty of God working, orchestrating events to make it happen, the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms to prevent it from, it's a very sacred moment. Well, the guys at the particular church that we went to, they were so ready for me. And they took me under their wings and showed me the ropes, and I became a follower of Jesus. And that is when things started to turn around. Now, it was a year later, and I'm going to take a breath here in a minute, but I started at 25 a process of reconciliation and healing with my parents. When I left home, as far as I was concerned, you know, I was done. I was gone. See ya. And it was in a strange relationship. But Jesus started to change that. And so I began doing the things that would heal childhood wounds and break the cycle when I was 25. And it took me until the age of 53 to do it, 28 years to complete this process. So I wrote this book because a guy actually... Now I know. I didn't know then. You don't know what you don't know. Now I know you can do in about 3 months what it took me 28 years to do. So I've compressed all that down and put it into this book. And this is not just, guys, this is not just a book about principles and theory and so forth. This is has all that, of course, but it's actually a process, a biblical process. It's been around for thousands of years in constant use for thousands of years. And I'm going to show you how you can actually understand what happened to you. That's part one. Part two, to go through a healing process, that's part two. And then part three is to break the cycle going forward in your own family and with your friends and so forth. Sound like about the right description?
Oh, absolutely. So I want to bring something else out. I've never done this before with you, but during this time of brokenness and trying to figure it out, you're actually escalating in business, like astronomically, yeah. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So like one of the characteristics of broken boys, so, you know, adult children of alcoholics, they have their list and so forth, and different groups have their list. And so I felt like the fraternal order of broken boys, and that's what I call us, we need our own list. And so I started years ago developing a list. And one of the characteristics of broken boys is that we grow up to either be the responsible son or especially immature for our age. In other words, we either really get it all together and are overachievers, or we're trying to prove that our parents are either right or wrong. Overachievers are trying to prove their parents are wrong, and underachievers are trying to prove that their parents were right. And so this is one of the characteristics, kind of a little bit of an interesting distinction there. But yeah, so I obviously fell into that responsible son category. My other brothers went the other way.
And in your book, I love what you wrote in your book, because so many of the resources I read talk about, hey, I'm the hero, do what I tell you. But your book is different. You said this. You said, quote, "I'm offering to guide you as someone who's walked the path already through this time-tested process." And then you continued, "You can control your life. You can find healing starting now." So I love how you come at it as, "I'm not the star of the show. I'm just the guide guiding you." And you talked about in your book, and I would agree with this, you know, what is it, 50 to 60% of families end in divorce. And you had offered a statistic of 70 to 80% come from dysfunctional homes.
Right.
And I would agree that it's that all day long. So we have a lot of young men and older men growing up who have been, I like to say, wounded or they're broken. And so we need to find healing for these guys. So let us help us to explain this quote, and you talked about things that a child needs to be whole and not broken, which if 70 to 80% are from dysfunctional homes, we have a lot of broken men out there. You said this on page 23, you said, "To thrive, children need love, structure, roots, and wings." I've never heard that before. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so I'm a systems theory guy, so I'm always looking for taxonomies and ways to put things in. So, and that little taxonomy took me, you know, about three decades to put together. But so, but the idea is that every child, parenting is a sacred honor and privilege to build into the life of a child the things that are the result of, like self-confidence and knowing, having something you can do well, a sense of meaning and purpose, identity, all these things, from by putting together the right cocktail of love, structure, and then you can give too much structure, not enough, and I talk about that in the book, the results of that, and then roots, and that's the grounding, then the wings, that's the helping them to be grow to be independent on their own. So if you're listening, and you can say of your parents, "My parents were affirming," or "My parents were encouraging," then that means that you probably have the right cocktail of love, structure, roots, and wings. But what if you can't say that? Well, then you probably didn't, and you might say one or more of seven things. And I have about a page and a half on each of these in the book. That's the nice thing about being a men's author. You know, I don't have to spend 30 pages to say what I could summarize in one, you know. You might say, you know, "My parents were passive." I would say that of my parents. Uninvolved. A signature story of my childhood is that I guess my parents didn't come to my Little League games. But one day they decided they wanted to come. And so I begged them at about the age of 10 not to come to the game until I was in tears. And finally they said, "Oh, okay, we won't come." And then I threaded my baseball glove over the handlebars and cried for the entire 8-minute bike ride to the Little League field because they were not coming. Did I want them to come and cheer for me shamelessly? Of course I did. But my counselor, when I was 53, I went through counseling. That's what finally concluded this 28-year process. My counselor said that a little boy can't stand the thought that they're not precious in their parents' sight, that they're not the gleam in their mother's eye. And so we build up these stories. And so I don't really want you at my game. My counselor said that at a very early age, I made some kind of a vow. Well, if you don't want me, then I don't want you either. Or if you don't need me, then I don't need you either. So that created that whole dynamic was created by me saying my parents were passive. So that's just one. I won't go into so much detail for the other seven, but let me give them to you.
Yeah. I'm looking at them right now.
Are you? Okay.
On page 29. Yeah.
So my parents were passive. My parents were absent. So maybe by death, divorce, addiction, or who knows, maybe just workaholics chasing the American dream. We're not around. My parents were permissive. When we were dating, my wife said one day, she said, "You know, I think your parents gave you too much say."
Oh.
I mean, I did. I could do anything I wanted. And then fourth, my parents were enabling. So a neighbor had two teenage boys. They knocked out the floodlights with some rocks. at another neighbor's house, and the dad defended them instead of holding them, you know, responsible and accountable. And so just enabling is not, you know, we're supposed to help our children, but we also should require our children to do things that they can and should do for themselves and hold them responsible when they do things that they shouldn't do. That's when we don't, that's the classic definition of enabling. So, yeah. Okay. So we got enabling. My parents were demanding. You know, I had a guy put in a new fence just over outside the window here about 2 weeks ago, and I gave him one of my author copies of the book. And he's a very angry guy right now. And he took the book home, and his wife said to him, he said, you know, you really should read this book.
Yeah.
And but he was telling me, he said, my house, it was like growing up in Auschwitz. He said, my dad, it was like a concentration camp. And so he was just suppressed. All of this, he was never validated. He just grew up very angry. And then the sixth is my parents were angry. You know, maybe you've had to walk around on eggshells your whole life. You never know what's going to set your parents off or when, or maybe one or both. And then finally, my parents were belittling. If you would say my parents were belittling, they would make snarky remarks. Maybe they make fun of body parts or make jokes at your expense and at family gatherings and things like this. And I've got one guy at 68 years old now who's been reading the book, and he's still crushed today because of the belittling remarks mm-hmm. by his mother growing up. And so these are real wounds.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. And this is what I really appreciate about your book is you spend the front part of it identifying, hey, here's where I might be broken. Here's where I might be wounded. Here's where I might need healing. But you really seamlessly flow into, well, here's how you fix it. Here's how you know, because I mean, I think it's pretty clear we're all sinners. But more than that, we're all broken in some way. I think we all bring brokenness to the table. So let's identify it and let's move on. And even as you're going through your list right there, I'm like, oh, that was my dad. Oh, that was my mom. See, my parents divorced at 13, when I was 13.
Oh.
So I had a very permissive mom and a very demanding dad. And so as an adult, I sifted through this. I thought, okay, why do I have to perform? Why do I never feel like I'm good enough? And so I had to work through this stuff. Which has really been affirming to me as I've read through the book. But, you know, there's a lot of times us guys, you know how we are, Pat, we're reading this stuff going, I'm fine. But you list on page 39, you kind of go, okay, I know you may be saying you're fine, but if you fit into these nine categories, maybe you're not so fine. So we can walk through this a little bit, but what are some of the traits of a guy who, maybe his parents failed to meet some needs and he is more broken than he thinks?
Yeah. And I do want to also say about your comment about, so guys, if you're trying, the reason, okay, so I like to write books that are practical and give you the practical help you need to get you where you want to go. And I'm very solutions oriented, but here's the thing. If you are trying to solve the wrong problem, you can only succeed by accident. So we do need to take time to understand and unravel what actually happened.
Yeah.
So that's why in this book, part one is really spending a good deal of time to create the categories and the dynamics and so that a guy can self-identify himself. And by the way, every time I give one of these characteristics or attributes, I also give a reflection exercise so that you can think, okay, well, how did this affect me, you know, personally? So, yeah. So with that said, yeah, then once you identify with one of these seven or eight parenting styles, if your parents were encouraging, then, then the net of that is that this has had a dramatic impact on you. And you may not know that. You may not understand it, but that's why we need our own list. So the number one characteristic is that you're not sure that people really care about you. You know, and so Eric Erickson, the psychologist with his child development theory, he says the number one task of a child is trust, distrust. And so, you know, if you weren't, you know, you can't say everything every time, but to append to my earlier comments about my child experience, I have no recollection of ever hearing the words, I love you. Never heard the words, I'm proud of you. We believe in you. Here's some things you might want to know about the opposite gender. Here's some things you might want to know about education. And here's some things you might want to think about meaning and God and purpose in life. None of that. And we weren't a physically affectionate family either. We didn't hug either. So now I'm not naive, Jim. I'm not saying that none of these things ever happened. But isn't it interesting and significant that even at this stage in life, I still have no recollection of those things ever happening? And so if I wasn't held enough, I don't know, because I wasn't old enough to acknowledge or know those things, but if I wasn't held enough or didn't get the right amount of cooing and affection and so forth, then if you're listening and that happened to you, it's very possible that you would have grown up having a hard time that people really care about you. So when I walk into a room, even to this day, I walk in with a suspicion. Yeah, I walk into a room with a suspicion. Now I'm walking in the power of the Spirit. And by the way, I've been completely healed now for a good deal of time. I'm fully alive in Jesus. I will always have a limp. And guys, if you get healed from your childhood wounds through this book or through a counselor, whatever, I hope that'll be your case. That doesn't mean that you won't still have a limp, because some of these things have been around for a long, long time. And well, you get the picture.
Yep. Yeah. For sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this list was really good. Like, you are oversensitive and often misread what people intend.
Hey, stop talking about me.
Yeah, I know. What, you know, you're easily angered. That would describe, yeah, I would say, me as a parent.
Yeah.
You know, so these are some of the things you, speak to any of these if you want to. You're not sure what healthy male behavior looks like.
Yeah, that's probably one of the bigger ones, right?
Yeah.
You know, especially if you've grown up without that good structure, good loving structure. If your parents didn't have a vision for what they were doing, if they were just kind of going through the motions. And then especially if your dad, like my dad, I learned some really incredible things from my father. He was the most moral man that I ever remember knowing. So my life word today is integrity. And it's it's the thing I prize. And that's another thing about this book, is that I'm really wanting to help men have a more compassionate view of their parents. And I don't want them to understand how they can, if they want to, it's up to them. But if they would like to forgive them. Now, there's a spectrum here. So you may, if you're listening, your parents might have been pretty good people, but they also might have been more in the middle. It might have been irascible, or they could have even be toxic or evil. I mean, you could have suffered severe physical abuse or even sexual abuse. In my case, it's neglect. All right. It's a form of emotional abuse. That was very hard for me to reconcile, because my parents are such nice people. So whatever happened in my family happened out of ignorance, not malice. And at every step along the way. So I had big reconciliation moments at 25, 35, and 47 and 53. That covers the 24 really big markers that really were the turning points for me. And every time I approached my parents on these things, they were very receptive. They would have loved to have had the skill to be the initiators themselves, but they didn't. But they were very responsive when I took the initiative. And guys, I think you would be surprised at how much your parents would, unless they're just really off, you know, too far gone, how much they would ache inside to have an opportunity to reconcile and to apologize, mm-hmm, and to be forgiven, and then to ask for forgiveness as well.
Yeah, and you talk about that, and I think the forgiveness component is huge. I'm going to run down this list of nine real quick and see what you say. So the next one is number five is you're insecure and need constant reassurance. So that's always been an issue with me, probably for most overachievers, right?
And it's also true that anybody who's had belittling parents in particular, but also angry and demanding parents, and, you know, any parent that is putting down their kids or having high requirements for conformity or performance in order to make your parents happy or avoid their wrath, they're very likely to suffer from that one. And then the page and a half or whatever it is in the book, I give great descriptions. Well, I say they're great, but others might not think so. I thought they were pretty good. Descriptions of, so I tease that out so you could have enough information to be able to identify with that.
Yeah, I thought this was really good. I mean, my parents went through divorce, and I would say I'm very close to both my parents today. However, they are not perfect people. They are also bringing their brokenness to the table. And in my maturity, I've had to acknowledge that. But I also had to acknowledge, hey, there are some things on the, and I'm being open and very vulnerable with my audience here. The next one you have is you've got dramatic mood swings. You don't know why. So I've done that as a parent. So I've made, you know, that has manifested in my marriage and my parenting. The next one you had, number seven, is you're either the responsible son or the immature one for your age. So I was the hero. Right. Number eight, you can't get rid of the negative voices in your head. I had no problem with that one. Just the opposite. And then number nine is you've cut yourself off from family members emotionally or physically. So these are the nine. So guys, if you're listening and any of those describe you, this isn't about you moping around talking about how wounded and hurt you are. This is about you saying, hey, this first section of the book identifies, hey, where am I not whole and where am I not my best version so that I can get there, right? I mean, that's what the book is about.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, I mean, in life, I tend to sometimes want to oversimplify things, but I think the choice is, do you want to be a victim or a victor?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm gonna take two quotes that are about 40 pages apart here. On page 23 and page 69, you said something that were very similar. I'm going to read them. You'll need to get your head around what went wrong. I mean, I just think that's the bottom line in our lives, right? We're problem solvers. We're fixers. We're men. We're conquerors. So you need to get your head around what went wrong, because if you're trying to solve the wrong problem, you can only succeed by accident. Then you continue on page 69. Healing is not about pain. Acknowledging it's there, identifying it's where it's coming from, and then knowing how to face it, grieve it, accept it, and take control and heal. So that's what it's about. It's all about, did I say not about pain? It's all about pain. It's all about saying, hey, I've got this wound, I've got this injury, I've got this broken thing, and I need to acknowledge it, identify for where it came from, know how to grieve it, face it, accept it, take control, and heal. So when a man is, we're going through this stage here, is that the first step, the identification step? What's the first step?
So what you've given there is a summary of part two of the book, essentially. And the first step, I'll tell you, the first step is facing the truth and getting out of denial. I'll tell you a great story. When I was writing the book, so it took me from 53 until it was, okay, 7 years ago, I decided finally that I should write the book. And then it took another 6 years for me to actually sort out how I could do it without throwing my parents under the bus. Yeah, because I didn't want to do that. I wanted to honor my mom and dad. So I did. I wrote this book in such a way that I felt like my mom, my dad, and I could sit down in a room together and we could agree, yes, that's actually what happened. And it's painful, but we have seen beautiful and lasting changes in our relationship and in our family. Astonishing things have happened, beautiful things. And we want other people to know that story. So, facing the truth and getting out of denial. When I was writing the book, I recalled that I used to race motocross in college. And so my mom and dad decided they would come to one of the races. They'd never been to a race before. That happened to be the day that I got in this nasty accident and got flown to the hospital in a helicopter. Well, my parents didn't come to the emergency room, and they never called to see how I was doing. What you would think that that would be such a painful memory that that would have just ripped me apart. You know, how would you ever get over that? You know, parents didn't even care enough to even call to see how you did after being flown to the hospital in a helicopter, right? But here's the thing. Until I was writing the book, I literally couldn't, I didn't remember that story. That's how powerful denial is. So, you know, we all compartmentalize negative thoughts, but denial is more. Denial, guys, are you ready for this? Denial is emotional amnesia. You literally can't remember. And so one of the things that will happen in this in the process of going through this book for you, it's going to be moving up all the time. But when you come to this point of facing the truth, you are going to have to then next go through a process of grieving what could have been, what should have been, you know, what you missed. And there may be some tears there, but that's going to be okay.
Well, it's really interesting. When I got to this on page 75, I've never heard somebody call denial emotional amnesia. What a stroke of genius. I don't know if you're the first one to come up with that phrase. I'd never heard it before.
Well, I coined it, but, you know, I've also learned over the years that there's, you know, oftentimes there are other people have done said things too, but yeah, nobody else has claimed it yet, so maybe it's mine.
No, this was a I mean, when I heard that, I thought, okay, that's it. We've heard the phrase denial 1,000 times.
Yeah.
But emotional amnesia, when you have an event like that where your parents finally come to one of your events, you get seriously injured and they just kind of blow it. I'm not going to say they blew it off. I'm just going to say they didn't show up. That's just an objective way. And then when you talk about grieving what's missing, can you walk us through that a little more?
Yeah. So denial is forgetting, grieving is remembering. That's it.
Oh,
you're actually trying to remember. Grieving, you know, facing the truth and getting out of denial, and then grieving, it's just actually trying to remember what happened to you, and then allowing through prayer and through hopefully a small group or maybe a spouse, being able to talk about it with people. Sometimes you may need to go to a counselor if what you uncover is something that's so radical that traumatized makes you feel like you're in trauma all over again. So grieving is actually entering into it. So what happened with my counselor? So I might as well say this. So when I turned 53, my mom died. I didn't feel anything. I wasn't sad. I didn't cry. I didn't miss her. I thought that was pretty strange, because at that point we were talking, you know, we were saying I love you to each other and things like that. So I made an appointment with a counselor, and over 8 sessions, she helped me grieve and understand and put into words the father and mother wounds that I'd never been able to articulate. And so she said, she started talking about, I believe that you're the product of gross abandonment. And I wanted to get up and strangle her. I said, you don't know about my parents. And then I defended my parents, you know. But anyway, after a few sessions, I finally began to understand. Well, one time she said, I believe that you are the product of gross abandonment. And then I said, my mom made me a cape when I was the king of my sixth grade class. She dyed it with her own hands. She dyed a sheet red and put and sewed gold fringe around the road. That doesn't sound like gross abandonment to me. And so she says, well, maybe she just liked the idea of being considered a great mom. So anyway, I said, what are you doing here? You're trying to rock my world. Well, she did. She said, look, you have been the product of gross abandonment and neglect, and you've been abused, and you need to face that truth, and you need to grieve it. And so she said this, and I'll say it to the guys, and I say it in the book as well. I want you to go, and I want you to, remember, and I want you to grieve, and I want you to have a good cry. And then she said this, I don't want you to manufacture feelings, but I don't want you to try to avoid them either. And so I made notes. I don't know why I was doing it at the time. I write everything down. I journal extensively. So I wrote every, you know, after every session, I went away and made copious notes about the sessions. And so I did. After that session, I went away and I asked questions like, you know, well, why didn't my mom and dad, why didn't they come to my games? You know, And when our children, we lived in the same town, when our two children were growing up, why didn't they ever invite our two children for a sleepover, things like that? And then, you know, and then I got down to after 6 or 7 or 8, 10, I really started to feeling the emotion. And then I was writing down one of these notes, and I actually put it in the book somewhere. I was writing down one of these notes about why didn't my parents do that? And the tears came. And I was able finally to have that good cry. I didn't manufacture didn't have to manufacture that, but it happened. And it was like this incredible cleansing process. And the Holy Spirit was, you know, vivid and present. And that was able to get me to the end of the grieving. I was able to actually have a prayer. I repeat the prayer in the book as well. Mm-hmm, my mm-hmm, prayer. Mm-hmm, everybody mm-hmm. would have their own, of course.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is really good because as I process this, I went through a process similar just by default. I couldn't attribute it to my parents. I just said, something's not right with me and I need to figure out what it is. And through a process, I was able to uncover some things to get me to the next level. And mine revolved around peers and then parents. But you talk in your book about something, I think it is so powerful. And again, I think you might have coined this for the first time. So let's talk about
you heard it here first, folks.
I know, buddy. I'm telling you what, unilateral forgiveness. Can mm-hmm. you talk about that and how important that is once we get past the denial and grief stage?
Yeah. Yeah, so I do like this term, unilateral forgiveness. So Jesus actually teaches unilateral forgiveness without respect to what the other person does. Now, that doesn't mean that there can be a reconciliation unless there's some sorrow on the other person's part and they meet you halfway. But Jesus did not say, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who have sinned against us, provided they come on with a humble heart and bowed knee and beg for forgiveness, you know? Yeah, it's unilateral, and that's elsewhere in Scripture too. So as I was beginning to understand, well, what happened was when I turned 25 years of age, I'd been a believer for a year, and my parents invited my new wife and I, to come to Thanksgiving dinner. My brother had been off to war, and the family had not been together for several years. We were that family growing up, Jim, that had grace before meals, but we would do it like this. God is good, God is great, and we thank Him for this food. Amen.
Shame on you.
that was it, you know?
Yeah.
So we're all out there. I'm the oldest of four boys. All four boys were there. My brother was back from war, and my wife and my mom and dad, and we were sitting around the table, and my dad said, I'd like to pray today. And he starts out, said, Lord, Mom and I would just like to say thank you. And then he started blubbering and excused himself from the table, went into the bedroom. I went in after him. I said, Dad, is everything all right? What's the matter? Are you okay? And he said, yeah, I'm fine. He said, just that's your mother and I. We never thought we'd ever see our four boys together again. And something softened in me that day. And because Jesus had forgiven me unilaterally, I made a decision that day that I was going to forgive my parents. Now, I didn't have any of the tools and the ideas and resources that are in, you know, that I put together in the book, because I was just a kid myself, right? Just getting started. But it did change the dynamics of the family. Now, I didn't hear the words "I love you" until I was 35, and that's another story. But anyway, at that point, I did unilaterally forgive my parents, even though I'd never had an apology. It felt too awkward to actually. I was not equipped to talk about it. One of the things I do in the book is I equip guys to have awkward conversations with their parents if that's what they want to do.
Well, you know, I ended up writing a blessing letter to my dad. I wrote a letter thinking about all the good things, and that was a game changer for us. You know, just say, you know what? Yeah, I know you're not perfect. You know, he had a lot of regrets, but hey, you are a great dad. Here's why. And I think that was really, I think forgiveness, you know, in 1 John 1:9, the Bible doesn't say, if we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us all our sins, once we fix our lives. It doesn't say that. It's unilateral. And I think a lot of times in the church, you know, we don't take Luke 6 to heart. You know, pray for our enemies, pray for those who persecute you, bless those who hurt you. And I think, you know, when you talk about unilateral forgiveness, that is a, that might be a missing link that that we aren't telling men and women when who have been hurt.
Yes. But I think it's also, yes, exactly that. Forgiveness is the elephant in the room.
Yes.
It is. It's the elephant in the room. Now, we're you know, the idea is you may have some things you need to own, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. In telling any story, the tendency is to make ourselves the hero or the victim and the other person the villain. And I think this is especially true when we start talking about our parents. So I'm going to help men think that idea through and show them how they can guard against that and then make this unilateral forgiveness. Now, that doesn't mean I also will show guys if necessary. So like if you have parents that come over to your house and they say insulting things to your wife and make jokes about your kids, maybe body parts or something like that. And then I show you how you can warn them, you know, that, you know, this, we really can't have this kind of language. I can't allow this to continue. And so if you keep doing this, then we're going to have to set a boundary up here. And I show guys how to do that. So that may be, that may happen, but that doesn't mean you can't still forgive them unilaterally, because this is the Jesus way.
Well, and you, okay, I have a question. So step four talks about making amends. If my memory serves me correct, does that mean I need to go to my parents? Let's say it's a parent who hurt you and say, hey, you know, or is it me just saying, hey, this is where I'm coming from and just talk through it? What do you mean by making amends?
Okay. So first of all, there's enough complexity in that. Yeah. So Jim,
I know.
Yeah. So Jim, most of the books that I've written, I go on interviews. And I know that most people are not going to go out and buy the book. So I try to give them the guts of the book.
Yeah.
And have good ministry while we're together. This is not that book.
No.
You actually, this book, you actually have to do the book.
Yes.
Not just, yeah, you have to do the exercises and everything. And so this making amends thing, it is complex in one sense, but it's also simple. You, in another sense, and I'm going to show you how you can identify and own the ways that you have weaponized your childhood wounds. And so, and then I'm going to show you how you can have an awkward conversation with your parents. I'm going to show you how to start an awkward conversation with your parents that'll just completely diffuse the, now it doesn't mean that that they're going to be responsive depending on who they are. But in most cases, I really think most parents really do want the same things that we want. We want to have a good relationship. But if you grew up a broken boy, that's because they don't know how to do that.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Pat. So I've got three sons. They're 26, 28, and 30. And so I am just now realizing, because I look for it, because I've got guys like you on my show all the time, right? And I go, and I'm asking my kids, I'm looking for areas where I've hurt them in the past. And I have to go back and initiate the conversation like, hey, I'm sorry about this, you know, and really trying to work through that. And these things are still coming up, right? And so it's really interesting. Talk about the renewal part. Is that, you know, trying that, because it does come down to, you know, relationship, my relationship with God, my relationship with other people. What are your thoughts on renewing conversations?
Well, I'll tell you a story. In my early 30s, as I was now really starting to grow in my faith in Jesus, I really began to have a longing, maybe like an ache, to have a reconciliation with my father. And I invited him to lunch on his birthday, December 12th. And I said, Dad, you wouldn't want to go to lunch with me on your birthday, would you? You know, kind of very tentative asking. Yeah. And he said, yes. And I said, that'd be great. And so we went to lunch and we had a wonderful time. So we made that an annual tradition. when I was 35, after lunch on his birthday, we were walking out to our vehicles, and it turned out we were parked next to each other, my car and his truck. He was a working man. And Jim, I to this day, I really don't know what prompted me, but I said, "Dad, can I give you a hug?" And before the words were fully out of my mouth, he was charging me like a grizzly bear. And he threw his arms around me and he let out this deep primordial groan. Went on for like 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds. And then when we drew back from each other, our hands were on each other's shoulders. And I said, "I love you, Dad." And he said, "I love you too." And that was the first time I ever remember either being hugged or hearing the words, "I love you." And it transformed our family. I never spoke about it. I don't think my dad spoke about it, but God did something supernatural that day. And it became ridiculous. We became a family of embarrassing lovers. It's just like every time, a few months later, my brother, one of my younger brothers, he calls me on the phone. And at the end, he says, "Well, I love you, Pat." And I said, "Well, I love you too."
More.
And he said, "Well, I love you more than you love me."
I love this story. Yeah.
And I'm thinking, who are you? You know, what did you do with my brother? And then just to be funny, I said, "Well, no, I love you more than you love me, and always have and always will." And I hung up the phone.
You win. Well, that's that hard charging oldest firstborn, performance driven coming out. No, but I read that in the story, and that's the cool part is that this is, and even now you're showing emotion, reliving that day, God, here's the thing is that God wants us to be whole. God wants us to restore all relationships. So for us to walk, and I can't tell you how many guys I meet with that are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, who are Christian guys with estranged children, and they don't know how to start it. This doesn't just go with me reconciling with my parents. This goes with me reconciling with my children. See, this book is much deep, and this book is so easy to read. It's just really easy to read. So if guys are intimidated, this is not a hard book to read. It's very easy and practical. I really appreciated this. So, the hard part when we do restore these, do the best we can to find wholeness for us, we're still dealing with potentially, broken people who are still broken. So how do we renew our relationship, walk in forgiveness, grieve, deny, go through all the processes. But what if that person on the other end just doesn't understand and are still kind of breaking or breaching those guardrails we've set? How do we set healthy boundaries?
Yes. And so I'm very cognizant that two people might not be at the same level at the same time. In fact, it wouldn't be surprising at all, right? So I show you in the book how to bring the relationship back together if the timing's ready, and then what to do if it's not. Not warm, maybe it's warm, but not ready. If they're receptive, I talk about being receptive or not receptive. And then I talk about, toxicity and, what do you do when it's just not going to happen at all. And so no matter where you are on your journey with your own childhood wounds, if you have them, I think the big idea is that no matter how you got into your current situation, there's really only one way out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was my next question.
Okay.
Take it.
No, I want to hear your question.
Well, I'm just, you have a section called Finding Rest for Your Soul. And it's page 109. And hold on a second. Where am I here? You said, what's the one idea fully under, you wrote this in your file when you're writing the book. What's the one idea fully understood and fully believed that would change everything? And everything that you're sharing in your book and in your personal life and everything I've experienced in my personal life, it all started with one thing. I'm going to tell you this cool story, and I'll let you slam dunk this thing. I was with my father-in-law last weekend, And he said, "Hey, can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Yeah." And he's not, he's not a church guy. Let's just put it that way. Right. He just said, "Describe your, what Jesus has done for you in 5 words." And I thought, "Oh, are you kidding me?" I said, completely change my perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus is a game changer. So what was the one idea that you had when you wrote this question down?
So I use the big idea every day. And the net is that you will never really fully enjoy all that God has for you as a man until you embrace Jesus. And so in this book, How to Find Rest for Your Soul, the book works for a man. You don't have to believe in God. You don't have to be religious for this book to work for you. But if you really want to go all the way and you really want to make a full break with the past, if you want to see a complete healing, then the idea here is that who you are or can be in Jesus, that's who you really are. That's your true identity. That's how you really find rest for your soul. And so I'm going to show you enough about, most people have heard cliches about Christianity and about the gospel and so forth, but I'm going to show you what the people who actually know what they're talking about believe about Jesus and about how you can have a relationship with him and how much he loves you. Jesus has this everlasting compassion and love for you. He says, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Just imagine how much the Father must love Jesus, and then that's the way that he's loved us. And so there's this incredible love. I learned, sidebar story, I suppose, but at the 14-year mark in my journey, and this is not in the book, I was in some kind of a business problem, and I was just crying out to God, and I was writing these things down in my computer. And I said, "God, you know how hard I've been working to be a good Christian, to how to be a godly man and a husband who really is invested in his wife and to be a dad who's in the picture and to be faithful with the money and to be a good steward and a man of integrity like my dad taught me to be, and how many little old ladies I've helped across the street. I mean, God, you know all these things. I just need some help here." And Jim, just like we're talking, I hear a voice in my head. It says, "Pat, nothing you do will ever make you good enough for me to love you. I love you because I made you." And that was the first day I ever understood grace. And so, there is grace available for you. Your wounds may describe you, but they do not have to define you.
Absolutely. That's such a beautiful statement. Well, you said something so powerful just now, and this is the theology I want guys to wrap their brains around. You said that God told you, I made you because I love you. And I would add, therefore, I love you because I made you. And yeah. Guys need to understand this, that God, you just can't get there. You'll just never get all the way unless you radically give your life to the God who loves you and made you. It just makes sense to me. It just theologically makes sense to me.
Yeah. Again, this is an idea that's not in the book, but I think it's the greatest lesson that I've ever learned. So I was in the middle of a business crisis, different one than that one. And a thought went through my mind, because I made some very silly mistakes. And the thought that went through my mind is this. See if this doesn't make sense, guys. There is a God we want, and there is a God who is. They are not the same God. And the turning point of our lives is when we stop seeking the God we want and start seeking the God who is. So it just dawned on me one day, you know, Morley, what were you thinking? Did you really think that any amount of you wanting to reinvent God in your imagination to be the God that you wanted him to be was going to have one iota of impact on his unchanging nature and character. And I realized that I've been trying to change, get God to change, and he was trying to get me to change. And so I realized that, and guys, this is important. It's what Jim is just talking about, is I realized that I must each day, every day, come humbly once again to the foot of the cross and once again make a full, total, complete surrender of my life to the Lordship of Jesus. And so I think in the book, I'm going to show you, if you haven't already started that journey, how you can, and then if you want to take it further, how you can take it further and really break the cycle in your own marriage, if you have it, or future marriage, or married again, whatever the case might be, and with your children, if you do have them or decide to have them, and also with your friends and other men.
Well, this is so good, and this book is so rich, and we're actually going to upload this on Friday, because we want to get this out to men. And it's so interesting that we have Easter on. Good Friday is Friday. Sunday is Easter. But April 1st is what I call National Atheist Holiday. Psalm 14:1 says, "The fool in his heart says there is no God." So guys, listen, if you are a functional atheist, you're a guy calling yourself a Christian, but you haven't radically given yourself to the God of the Bible, not the God you've made up, I want to encourage you to do that soon so that you can find not only healing for your soul and peace for your soul, but that you can become the best version in Christ that God has called you to be. So I'm not going to leave today, Pat, without asking you this. I know that this is an author's copy, so this is not a for sale copy. So when does the book come out and how do they get it?
Okay, so the book came out March 19th, so last Tuesday, and it's available, you know, everywhere. If you go to patrickmorley.com and buy it through the website, I get a 4.5% commission, which we get to use to help cover the expenses of the ministry. I take nothing out of the ministry. And, but yeah, and you could also get all the other booksellers there too, Tyndall, Books a Million, whatever it is, and Barnes and Noble, all those people. You can get the book anywhere. 70% of all books are sold on Amazon. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did. I did know that. Whoa. Because we push hard for Amazon because it's just a click away. So, well, Pat, thanks so much for all you've done over the last almost three decades now working with men. I mean, millions and millions of men and families reached. I just can't even imagine what it's going to look like the day you cross over and meet Jesus and he pulls you up and he says, "Look at the people behind you. These are all people that you impacted." So I'm one of them. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Jim. And thank you, men, for listening. If you made it this far, I just want you to know that you're in my prayers before the show today. And I'm going to say a quick prayer when we hang up as well.
All right, man. God bless you. Have a great day.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Yep.
Bye for now.
Man, we want to thank you for being a podcast listener who's helped us become Spotify's number one podcast for Christian men. But if you have yet to subscribe to the Men in Arena podcast, please do so now. God bless you. Until next time, feel the wet sand on the arena floor. Hear the deafening roar of the crowd. Taste the sweetness of victory. Smell the stench of battle. Get in the game. Get dirty. Grind it out. And be a man.